Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's show, Dale DeGroff of the American Cocktail Museum joins forces with Simon Ford of the 86 Company, a fine distillers collaborative, to discuss new flavors and trends in the world of craft cocktails. Then, author Taylor Mathis joins us for an exploration of Southern Collegiate tailgating. All you LSU fans will love Taylor's tale about transforming a pig roast into an elephant roast when the Alabama rivalry heats up. And we'll hear from Bill Heavey about the bizarre lengths he went to while eating only wild foraged food for a whole year. We're covering the Southern food scene and serving it with some fine cocktails on this week's Louisiana Eats. New Orleans has been home to the Museum of the American Cocktail since 2004, giving museum founder, master mixologist Dale DeGroff, ample reason to frequent the Crescent City. The spirited French Quarter restaurant, Sobu, often partners with the museum, hosting cocktail seminars that are as informative as they are fun. Recently, we sat down at Sobu with Dale and Simon Ford, co-founder of Company 86, a collaboration with distillers of fine spirits, to discuss the latest trends and flavors in the world of cocktails. So, hi, guys. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Poppy.
You make us sound so important.
We're a couple of bartenders. Yeah.
but we imported you bartenders. Not that, you know, Louisiana doesn't have a plethora of them already. We imported you all specially.
You invented them.
Simon, let's begin by discussing distilling. Classic spirits, like bourbons and scotches, were originally distilled to be sipped, not mixed. But in today's new world of distilling, the emphasis on new liquors really seems to be on the mixing end of it. So how does the 86 Company approach this?
Well, it's really interesting. I was reading a little story about the Hurricane, one of New Orleans cocktails today. And of course, you know, one of its stories is it was created by Pat O'Brien, who was trying to get rid of some cheap, nasty rum. And once upon a time, there was a perception that you just put really bad liquids into cocktails. But actually, if you go back in time, it was always the best spirits that went in cocktails. And now that there's a cocktail renaissance and it's back in vogue to make great drinks, working with great spirits is really, really important. And how they mix is ultimately what gives a good cocktail. Someone said to us, right, your cocktail is only as good as your worst ingredient. So you should be putting good spirits in it, fresh juices, and all of those different things. So what we did at the 86 is we really looked at what the classic drinks were, whether it was a daiquiri, whether it was just a great vodka martini, gin martini, and we started testing the batches of gin that we were making in martinis and figuring out how to change the batches to make a better martini and a better gin and tonic. And that's really what we thought about, because we do sip some drinks, but most drinks are served mixed, and so you want a good mixed spirit.
Well, since you brought up martinis, I have to ask the master mixologist here on hand.
Yeah, you do.
I remember at a Tales of the Cocktail dinner one time, there was this heated discussion at the table over how do you make your martini. So tell us about what Dale DeGroff.
That's a personal question.
Yeah, what's your 2013 martini like, Dale DeGroff?
It's, to tell you the truth, I fool around. I mean, I do the Fitty Fitty, which our dear friend Audrey Saunders created at, and she created, I mean, the Knickerbocker Hotel in 1909 was serving martinis with Plymouth gin and Noilly Pratt half and a dash of orange bitter, so it's nothing new. That was, in fact, the first dry martini. But it's like, what is it like? It's like barbecue. It's like Bloody Marys. Everybody thinks their martini recipe is best. And really what it is up to the bartender to do is to walk up to that guest who orders the martini I'll have and then make it exactly the way that guy wants it. That's your job. And you have to do it right in front of him. And there's got to be ceremony. Otherwise, they're not happy.
Well, you have dazzled me with your ceremony on several occasions, I have to say.
It's such a personal experience, the martini. I think it's like ordering coffee at Starbucks. Do you want a hazelnut in it or not, right?
Don't you dare tell me. My favorite bar is now a Starbucks in New York City. You're killing me with this.
Well, Simon, as much as microbrewers were really the hot new thing in America 20 years ago, today, really, micro distilling is the huge new movement. Talk to me about what you see happening in America and across the world.
Yeah, right now, I mean, it's amazing. When I was first trying all of those beers of the craft beer movement, I was sort of, some of them were pretty terrible, right? Move forward 20 years, and they're all amazing. It's one of the best scenes there is. And the same thing's happening now with the craft spirits. Everybody's having a go. Everyone's experimenting. There's a lot of hits, and there's a lot of misses out there. But in 10 years, the craft spirits movement will be a force to be reckoned with. I think it will, just like the beers today, it will be what we are drinking and what we're looking to do because they all have perfected their recipes. What I decided to do was actually take a bartender's perspective and talk to some of these craft distillers and give them our opinions on what and the way the spirits should taste. So I feel like we're a little bit of a hybrid between craft distillers and bartenders really giving their input on how spirits should taste.
And what are the various spirits in your line right now?
It's fun. So we actually tried to make 5. We ended up with 4. We have a rum, which is a light rum from Panama. We have a gin that we made in London with an 8th generation gin distiller called Charles Maxwell. We have a tequila that we did with the Vivanco family, and you know, obviously from Miranda's in Mexico. And then we ended up making a vodka almost by accident. We were actually originally making a rye whiskey with these guys up in Canada.
Yeah.
We came back with a very average whiskey. It wasn't as good as we would have liked, which is why we didn't put it out. But the vodka was surprisingly good. And even though the world doesn't need another vodka, we just couldn't resist putting out this vodka because we thought it tasted good and fit the profile of being full, viscous, holding flavor in cocktails. And so we ended up giving it a silly name, though. It's called Aylesbury Duck Vodka. So at least our vodka comes with some humor.
But vodka with rye is I've thought of all the things I've heard they make.
No, actually, we didn't make it with rye. We made it with wheat.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so obviously up in Canada, there's 97% of their crops were rye, and 3% were wheat, and they weren't using them. And they're like, do you want to use them? And we're like, okay.
Where's the distilling going on?
Now the distilling, that's the interesting question, because we distill the vodka up in the Alberta distilleries in Canada. We make our rum in Panama with a guy called Don Panjo Fernandez. He was the original minister of Cuban rum for 35 years, and he went and built a distillery down in Panama making rums with the local sugarcane down there. So that's great. Obviously, the tequila has to come from Mexico by law. And gin, we went to London for the gin because the best botanicals in the world go there. But what we do is we ship everything in bulk to California, and there's a place in Charbay where we add the water. It's a logistical nightmare, but we're working with some of the best distillers from around the world and bringing it all into the United States for the cocktail bartending community.
That is really cool. Now, Dale, have you found that distilling in the United States is an extra challenge for a company?
It had been. The small distiller was facing some serious uphill issues when it came to taxing, et cetera, but state by state, they started lightening up on some of these artisan guys to encourage them. 10 years ago, 12 years ago, there may have been 13 or 14 licenses for small artisan distillers. There's over 300 now, at least,
Wow. And
growing every year by about 10. And they're making so many more things than they ever made before. And so from the artisan distiller's point of view, it's never been a rosier picture than it is right now. A lot of farm to table, farm to bottle.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? A lot of people actually have the farm. And then there are wine guys on the North Shore of Long Island making really good wines, and also grappa.
So, Dale, when it comes to the mixing, I know that one ingredient that has been in your secret arsenal is always bitters and the use of bitters. And now you've been inspired to actually create your own bitters. Mm-hmm. So tell me about the pimento bitters.
Well, when the Spanish explorers came to South America 300 plus years ago, they saw the Indians putting these black berries into their food and beverage, and they thought they were peppercorns, so they called them pimento. And it took another 100 years before a an English botanist took some of them back home and realized that it was, in fact, not pepper, but it was a single spice that would exhibit the aromas of not only ginger, but also nutmeg and clove and cinnamon, and he called it allspice. I decided to go with the Spanish because the liquor that you find in the Caribbean, specifically one that inspired me to do the spirits, which was called Rey and Nephew Pimento Dram Liqueur, was made, in fact, from these berries and was very intense and very, very, very concentrated. I used to use it in dashes, and then they pulled it off the market because it turns out at the Rainbow Room, I was one of two people in the United States buying this liqueur, you know, and I only bought like two bottles a month because I used it as a bitters almost. So it was gone, and I was missing that ingredient. And for a long time, I just took it out of my recipes. And then I was sitting around, and I thought, well, why not just get some 100-proof vodka and throw some pimento berries in there and a few other things and see where I can go with this. And I played around with it for about a year, and I got where I liked it. And I sent it off to a friend of ours, Ted Bro.
Of course.
And, you know, Ted knows all about botanicals. I said, Ted, can you make this stuff for me? And Ted said, hell yeah, I can make it for you. Now we have a bitters that is made 90% pimento berries and then a bitter orange peel, no longer star anise, which I found out 90% of the star anise in the world goes to flu vaccination. Hello.
Wow.
Who knew? And so he said, that's not the best for spirits and beverage anyway. I would say go with green anise, which we did. And then one other ingredient, which Ted will kill me if I tell anybody about, and a little bit of Demerara sugar, because even though it's bitter, 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 you don't want it so bitter that it's so off-putting that people can't even think about putting it on their tongue.
So generally, explain to me why you think the bitters category has exploded so.
It was what defined the cocktail. And as the craft cocktail movement accelerated and young people around the country realized it was okay to be a bartender again and started exploring all the possibilities and seeing what the original 19th century had done with bitters when there were so many bitters brands and so many interesting ones, they started looking at those old recipes, recreating them in their kitchens, in their bars. Then some of them got serious about it and said, geez, I can make some money making this product. And suddenly, you know, now I have a picture at home of 35 or 40 bitters bottles, and that's only the beginning.
Wow.
You know?
The interesting thing about bitters is cooks and chefs have their spice rack.
Yes.
Bartenders have their bitters, and it serves the same purpose, but for the drinks, they're the seasonings that you put in. You know, you make a drink, and you go, I could season this. As an example, how I use your pimento bitters is I make a daiquiri, and I just think, just something else, just a little extra. And you just add a dash, and it changes the recipe, and it just adds that something else. And that's what bitters really are. It's the best way to understand them.
I got stuck one time. A customer, we had this idea that we would create drinks a la minute for customers at the Rainbow Room. And once we started it, we were stuck with it. And this guy came up and said, I want a new gin drink for the summertime. I'm tired of gin and tonic. Do something for me. And I was busy. And so I threw together a gin sour and let it set for a minute as I thought about it, because I thought, there's my base. So I just took the bitters and went boom, 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 boom with four good dashes. It turned it copper-colored and totally changed the character of the drink. The guy took a sip of it, and he said, yeah, that's what I'm looking for.
Well, it sounds like a delicious mix of the old and the new, which is exactly the way you gentlemen always strike me. There's always a big taste of history mixed right in there.
And I'm the old guy and he's the new guy? Is that what you're trying
to
say here?
No, Dale. I meant tradition. I meant tradition versus avant-garde. Is that better?
Thank you, Bob.
Oh, thank you. Well, thanks so much for taking this time to talk with us. And thrilled to meet you, Simon. I hope you'll come back like Dale does and be our guest again.
Absolutely. This was great fun.
Dale DeGroff, Museum of the American Cocktail founder, and Simon Ford of the Fine Distillers Collaborative, the 86 Company. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's hero was born into a famous Cajun musical family with Louisiana roots dating back to 1765. Our hero grew up attending weekly family fete-dodos, where his father and uncles, the famous Cajun band Les Frères Michaud, often performed. In his early teens, our heritage hero and his brother began to regularly sit in with Les Frères Michaud, playing a variety of Cajun instruments and singing along in traditional Cajun French.
The thing about preserving Cajun French language, the music has always been a huge part because, you know, when people want to learn the language, a lot of them happen to be musicians, and either way, they listen to the music. But where do you start? You know, do you start with the music? Do you start with the language? And so when you hear it in Cajun French, you can say, well, I know what that is in English, so that teaches me how to say it in Cajun French.
After the devastating hurricanes in 2005, our heritage hero began to recognize how endangered the heirloom seeds of Acadiana had become. He began gathering seeds suited for Louisiana's steamy hot climate, like the longhorn okra, fathorn okra, and Zydeco Bear Violette, an exotically purple-striped green bean. While seed collecting, our hero also gathered medicinal secrets from French Acadian traiteurs. He learned that brilliant red mamou seeds could be steeped into a cough syrup that's said to be more effective than traditional drugstore brands. Our heritage hero began his own nonprofit organization, the Cultural Research Institute of Acadiana, whose acronym is CRIE, which means to cry out in Cajun French.
Our main mission is to collect and preserve all the heirloom seeds that have been in South Louisiana families for, in some cases, hundreds of years, whether it be through the Native Americans or the Africans or the French or the Germans or whatever seeds they brought with them into the New World. And so many of these varieties are still around and being planted every year by people, but don't make it down to the next generation because, one, they don't need it because you can go to the grocery store and buy everything you need. And for two, there might not be one in the family interested. So we're taking it upon ourselves to collect samples of as many different heirloom variety seeds as we can and to grow them out and make them more widespreadly available in South Louisiana and just to continue those amazing genetics that are in danger of being lost.
That's why this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero is Louis Michaud of the Lost Bayou Ramblers. Congratulations, Louis, and thank you for keeping alive the Cajun culture that is the source of real Louisiana Eats. We'll be back from a short break and tailgate Southern style with author Taylor Mathis. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. When it comes to tailgating, there is no doubt that Southern football fans have transformed that fun into a fine art. One of those fans is North Carolina-based Taylor Mathis, author of the Southern Tailgating Cookbook, a game day guide for lovers of food, football, and the South. Taylor, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Well, thanks for having me, Poppy.
Tell me how tailgating became your passion.
Well, the project all started back in 2010. I'm a food photographer for a living, and I started out doing a tour where I was going to college towns and just seeing what the food's like there. And just a little background on me, I grew up in Charlotte, but I actually went to the University of Wisconsin for college. I was a swimmer up there. So my tailgating days were in the Midwest. And I got to talking to my friend who went to Texas, and he was telling me what his traditions were like and what his game day was like. And you know, it was very different than my experience in Madison. So in the fall of 2010, I decided, you know, I'm going to go out and see what tailgating is like. And I went to 14 different games. Some out in Washington, some in the Midwest, and then the rest in the South. And from that, I decided to pursue it even further and went to another 15 games in 2011, all focused in the South, and then another six in 2012.
And so somewhere along the line, you decided to write a food blog called TaylorTakesATaste.com. So what can people find on TaylorTakesATaste.com?
So Taylor Takes a Taste started in January of 2010 as a way to improve my food photography and just kind of get out there and see what food was like in different parts of the country. So I did a lot of traveling in the beginning of it, but it's now evolved into a food blog where I take the pictures, and then my mom, who's a professional recipe developer, does the recipes with me. And most of it is tailgating or entertaining type food.
Well, your mom, Sally Jones, sounds like a secret weapon in the equation of this book. What part did she play?
She's amazing. It was great working with her on the food. When I was doing these tours, I would see games at noon, at 3, at 7, you know, tailgating in September, then at November. So I got a really good idea of, you know, how food changes throughout the season, and then if you're tailgating for 12 hours, you know, how can your dishes serve multiple uses throughout? So from my findings on these tours, I was able to talk with Sally, and we kind of decided what food would we like to have at a tailgate or any other type of entertaining event.
Well, that is a pretty big range in times of day. So what differences did you find between a noon tailgate versus a 3 p.m. or 7 p.m. game time?
Well, a lot of it is how many meals you want to make, and that's determined by how many hours you're out there. And for instance, when I was at LSU for a game, the game was at 2:30 because CBS decided to move it up. So I got there at 6 a.m. thinking, okay, you know, I'm going to be at the beginning as people are coming in. But LSU fans got there at 4:15. So when I got there at 6, they were on their second breakfast.
Well, that's for the hardcore. So they were on their second breakfast. And which count on the beer do you think they were at?
Not quite sure on that one, but you know, it was a couple probably. But how many meals you're going to have at your game is going to determine, you know, how early to get there, what to pack. But generally for like a noon game, most tailgaters will do one large meal, because if they get there at 7:30 or 8, about 4 hours before kickoff. But if you're getting there, you know, 2:30 or 3 o'clock game, you may do a meal right when you get there and then do another meal right before kickoff, or do some heavy appetizers and then another meal. But if you're there, you know, for 12 hours, you'll probably end up cooking 3 meals.
In your research and in all your traveling, what were the standout regional differences that you discovered amongst these tailgaters?
One of the coolest things was how tailgaters, they really choose to eat locally, especially where they're sourcing their proteins. For instance, when I was in Baton Rouge for that game, the crab boil I saw, the guy, he got his crabs from the Gulf and Lake Pontchartrain. And then when I was in Raleigh for a game, this fan, for his crab boil, he got his crabs from the North Carolina coast. So same recipe, but just where they source the proteins are different.
Very interesting. And what were the seasonal elements that you discovered as, you know, you went from basically late summer, start of football season, into the chilly December time?
That when you're out there in September, as you said, it's late summer. It can mean 95 or even 100 degrees still. So you'd want those refreshing, cool beverages, and you'd want the entrees that are kind of lighter so you don't feel weighed down with them. But on the other hand, if it's November and it's 30 degrees when you get out there in the morning, you're going to want your heavy chilies and stews. So really, that temperature is going to kind of gauge what you put on your menu.
Well, as you travel around, your book includes so much more than just recipes, even though there are actually 110 recipes in the book. And needless to say, the photography, I mean, it's not just food photographs. You've got band photographs. You've got marching band photographs. And could you give me some examples of what people might see?
That was probably my favorite part of the whole project, was just going to different campuses and just immersing myself into what is it like being on that campus for game day. Because every school is going to have traditions that, you know, are unique to them. And within the book, there are these 15 sidebars that take a topic, for instance, like pregame walks, where the players walk to the stadium that almost every school has, but it talks about how each school does it a little differently. For instance, at LSU, they've got Mike the Tiger leading the way. Their live tiger that's right across from the stadium. You know, that's the only place that has a live tiger leading their players to the field. Then just every campus, their school colors, you'll see everyone decked out in you know, red and blue, or blue and orange, or purple and gold. So that was just cool to see, just everywhere I went, how you have 100,000 people all wearing one of two colors.
Another picture that really caught my attention, there's a photograph in your book of how the LSU fans transformed a pig, like they were doing a traditional boucherie, but somehow they turned it into an elephant the day they were competing with Alabama.
That's correct. It was one of the coolest things I've seen, and it's in the sidebar about eating your competition, and that's the epitome of eating your competition, because you can't really cook an elephant in a tailgate, but turning a pig into it, you know, that was it. But they were actually cooking two pigs. So they took some of the skin from the other pig and formed it into the giant ears and the giant trunk. I even saw some Alabama fans, you know, getting their picture taken with it because they admitted that was pretty cool.
Now, you're going to have to be very careful about how you answer this particular tricky question because you have to consider the audience, Taylor. But how do the LSU Tiger fans fit into your overall view of the Southern tailgating scene?
Well, I'll put it this way. It's the only place I went to that I ate seven different animals in one day.
Yeah, what can you name them?
Yes, I had chicken, beef, pork, shrimp, crab, alligator, and frog.
Oh, my gosh. Yep, that's how it is down here in the swamps. If you had to rank the Tiger fans with a BCS ranking, how'd you rank them?
Well, if you're a fan of Cajun food, you know, it's a place you need to go. And I get the question all the time of, oh, what's the best tailgate? I can't just say one because everyone is great for different reasons. But eating and spending a game day at LSU is definitely in my top five, along with taking a boat to a game in Tennessee or going to a horse race and a tailgate in Lexington or the Texas-Oklahoma game with the State Fair. Or going to a giant tent city like the Quad in Alabama or the Grove at Ole Miss.
Yeah, and things get pretty elegant at Ole Miss, don't they?
They do. You have the chandeliers hanging down, and you'll have, you know, people serving and giant silver dishes.
Yes, they sure are formal up there in Oxford. Taylor, what are some of the most delicious things that you tasted in your tailgating travels?
Ooh, that's a tough question. When I was at LSU, definitely, whenever I walked by a giant pot of gumbos there, you know, someone would offer me a bowl or, you know, having a fried frog leg. It was just really cool to see the variety and the passion that people put into their food. For instance, when I was in Florida for a game, they got there, I think, 2:30 in the morning to start cooking a pig on a spit for a 7 p.m. kickoff the next day. So that was delicious as well.
How much prepared on-site food did you find versus people bringing their already cooked food?
It all kind of depended on what their tailgating style was, because really there's no wrong way to tailgate. As long as you're enjoying game day and having fun, you know, that's how you should tailgate. So it just depends on what people wanted to do. You'll have some people who get there, you know, 12 hours early to cook a pig, or they just like to be there and have three meals. But then you have other people who get there, you know, 4 hours before, and they just have a grill and keep it a lot simpler. But, you know, both sets of people are going to have a great game day.
Well, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time from your tailgating fall fun to talk with us about your new book. Thank you, Taylor.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Poppy.
Taylor Mathis, author of the Southern Tailgating Cookbook. Louisiana Eats rambling reporter Ian McNulty covers the restaurant scene for the New Orleans Advocate, and he's also the author of Louisiana Rambles, an off-the-beaten-path exploration of our state's heartland. No one is a better food sleuth than our friend Ian. So, Ian, where you been rambling lately?
Oh, hey, Poppy. I've been going out to Lafayette. And, you know, a lot of times when I'm on your show, I'm talking about these little places that are down some back road, small town places. And usually talk about these places that are real traditional Louisiana. Fried seafood, boiled seafood, gumbo. Love those places. Love them, love them, love them.
Gator heads on the wall.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah,
you're, taxidermied birds.
Precisely, yeah. And I mean, that is the heart of traditional Cajun cooking in the restaurant scene. I love it. But I want to bring in a few more places that are a little more contemporary, but still let you know that you're right here in Louisiana. And one of those places I want to talk about today is called Bon Ton Grill. The name is, it sounds like it could be anywhere in Louisiana, right?
Yeah.
This one is right outside of downtown Lafayette, where the city starts to spread out a bit and get a little more
suburban.
Almost to the rural point, you know, yeah. Some warehouses around and stuff like that. But you get inside and you find this kind of cool look. There's all this like repurposed wood, kind of gives it that neat but still funky feel, you know, pressed tin ceiling, mix of tables and these big red plush booths, bar in the corner, TV showing the game. Family friendly, but not one of these like big dining hall type of restaurants either. And then we get into the menu and they call it sort of edge of the swamp food comes to the city. That's the way they describe it.
Interesting.
And it's pretty accurate. I mean, you're going to find things here like frog legs with garlic butter, you know, but also tuna tartare, like raw tuna chopped up with avocado in a moat of ponzu sauce with wonton chips, something you'd find at a sushi bar, right?
That's quite a departure.
Yes. blackened chicken, of course, that's a standard Cajun dish, but here wrapped up in bib lettuce, that crisp, really green, crunchy lettuce with like a Thai-style peanut sauce on that. You can get this combo plate with duck wings and alligator with like a jicama slaw, you know, that
crunchy,
exactly, yeah, wet, refreshing, with mango sauce on that. Meat boards, these meat plates. We see these everywhere now, right, at contemporary restaurants.
Yeah, charcuterie has become almost de rigueur.
For sure. Well, they've been doing it for a long time in Cajun country, and here is a meat board that kind of like combines like the contemporary, like, oh, we love charcuterie with like, hey, this is what we've always done. So there's boudin and all these various sausages, but now you can dip them in a little aioli with some pickled onions on the side, stuff like that. Lots of fish, trout, redfish, mahi-mahi. Last time I was there, you can get those grilled over mesquite. And they have some interesting sauces for them. I like the one that's a Satsuma Creole Meunière. Kind of a good citrusy, buttery kind of thing there. And then this dish, gator stuffed with boudin and cheese, and then they grill it. Real interesting.
That is bizarre. How do they even do that? Is it a hollowed out gator tail?
They take what they say is gator leg, and they stuff it with boudin and cheese, and then grill the sucker up. Now, you can still get gumbo here and steaks and your seafood pasta. And then this dish, which is very traditional, but I love it. It's their crawfish pot pie. And basically, it's crawfish etouffee meets a pot pie. A big bowl filled with rice, plump tails of the crawfish, this creamy, mellow, buttery sort of roux sauce combination, all capped over with this flaky crust that it, clearly handmade. You know, it's irregular and buttery and delicious. And, you know, you just break into that with your spoon and start slurping. So this is a pretty busy place, especially it's open for lunch and dinner, but at night it gets pretty busy and on the weekends too. Normal to find a little wait here. There's no reservations, but you can just put your name in. And, you know, when the games are on, you're going to see lots of Raging Cajun fans in there watching TV, eating some really interesting food and having a great time at the Bon Ton Grill.
Thanks, Ian. See you soon.
Great, Poppy. Thanks a lot.
Louisiana Eats rambling reporter, Ian McNulty.
After the next short break, we'll talk with Bill Heavey about the year he spent eating only wild foraged food. At one point, Bill found himself knee-deep in the Louisiana swamps in search of a bayou delicacy. You don't want to miss this one. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Mm-hmm. No matter what the temperature is, when fall arrives here in the state known as Sportsman's Paradise, hunters everywhere get out the camouflage, prepare the duck blinds, and get ready for the hunt. No one was ever more excited to sound the duck call than Louisiana-born, Sulphur resident, my friend Billy Cox. And in Billy's neck of the woods, there was no dish more prized by friends and family alike than Billy's wild duck gumbo. That gumbo traveled everywhere with him. He brought it along on winter skiing vacations and was even known to pull out his last reserves for summer beach meals in Florida. Tragically, in early September, we lost our friend Billy Cox. I know now he's hunting in the true sportsman's paradise, but for those of us he left behind, we'll remember Billy by enjoying his famous duck gumbo. Here's how he made it. First, in a stock pot, he'd combine chopped onions, celery, and bell pepper, along with a fistful of bay leaves and as many cleaned teal and mallard ducks that he'd been lucky enough to have bagged. He'd cover it all with water and first bring the pot to a boil, then simmer till the duck meat was falling off the bone. Next, he'd strain off the stock, and when the ducks were cool enough, he'd pull off all the meat. Then, Billy'd get down to serious business. His thick, dark brown, velvety roux was the thing that made Billy's gumbo stand out from what's usually served in Southwest Louisiana. In a frying pan, he'd brown some smoked sausage, and then, in the same oil, he'd cook down his seasoning vegetables, an entire separate set of chopped onions, celery, and bell pepper. Finally, everything was combined in a soup pot with three or more bay leaves, some salt, and some Tabasco sauce. The flavor of bay leaf was another distinctive element in Billy's famous duck gumbo. After simmering another hour or more, it was finally ready to serve. As all gumbos are, his duck gumbo was ladled over Louisiana long grain rice, but catch this, Billy secretly enjoyed eating his with chunks of cheddar cheese stirred into the gumbo bowl. For a copy of Billy's Wild Duck Gumbo, visit our website at LouisianaEatsRadio.com. Happy hunting, Billy. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Bill Heavey is at home in the great outdoors, where hunting and fishing have been his lifelong passion. He's the editor-at-large of Field & Stream magazine and widely regarded as the magazine's most popular voice. Several years ago, Bill wandered off the grid from his typical hunting and gathering in a personal challenge to see how far he and his appetite could go. Starting near his home in the Virginia suburbs of D.C. and reaching far beyond. His adventurous experiment resulted in a book, It's Only Slow Food Until You Try to Eat It. I asked Bill Heavey what he discovered in the process.
It was really hard. I found out pretty quickly that while I could probably survive on what I got, it would be incredibly dull to eat and to write about and to read about.
Oh.
So the book sort of changed as I got into it. And as I pursued foraging and gardening skills, I also decided to branch out and hang out with people for whom getting their own food was part of their everyday life.
Now, you are a self-described suburban hunter-gatherer. So give us a little, for instance, about how you would create a salad from lawn weeds.
This was a project I decided to do after I met another forager who I'm now engaged to.
Oh, congratulations.
who explained to me that most of the weeds that Americans spend enormous amounts of money to eradicate from their lawns are actually edible plants.
Like what?
There's plantain, wood sorrel, violets, wild alliums, which are onions and garlic, things like chickweed, dandelion, Indian strawberry. The problem I had was that I was trying to make this salad late in the season. These plants are most palatable when they first come out, but they're the hardest to identify, and this is a problem that goes all through foraging. If you look in foraging books, they identify the plants when they're in full flower because that's when they're easily distinguished. However, by that time, they're usually putting out bitter compounds into their leaves and stalks and flowers to protect themselves. So when they're most edible, they're least identifiable. When they're most identifiable, they're least edible.
You discovered along the way that edible does not really necessarily equate tasty, right?
Absolutely.
And what were the nastiest things you've eaten?
The nastiest things? Well, the lawn salad was pretty nasty. And in the lawn salad, I found out that garlic always gets the last word.
Yes.
I ate this stuff, and it was immensely fibrous, and I was chewing it until I thought I was developing new muscles in my jaw. But I could taste garlic for several days after that. But I tried to make flour from acorns. It's pretty hard to leach the bitter taste out of acorns. It can be done, but it's an enormous amount of work.
Do you think that perhaps an unpleasant taste correlates to something that maybe is possibly poisonous?
Oh, sure. In fact, for instance, there are two plants that look very much like each other. One is milkweed, which is very edible and pretty tasty, and the other is dogmane, which is poisonous. And there are many ways to identify the two, but the best way is to just take a tiny bite of the leaf, and that you know immediately, because if you've got dogmane, it's bitter, and you know not to eat it.
Well, during this experiment, did you ever poison yourself?
No, I didn't. I was pretty careful. It's funny, the first chapters of almost any foraging book gives you a list of plants that are poisonous. And in the Peterson's one that I used, they had asterisks by the ones that had documented kills to their credit. And out of like 93 poisonous plants, 27 or 30 had actually killed people. And a rule of thumb in foraging is not to eat anything your first year without having it verified by somebody with a lot more experience.
Well, that's probably very wise. Bill, tell me, what was the biggest problem that you encounter while foraging?
Well, I didn't have any idea that this would happen until I started foraging. But foraging is a very suspicious activity to other people. There's just something about it that really makes people look at you with suspicion. And I think it's because you're stepping outside the food system that we've all become so used to without ever giving any thought to it. I remember one day in a park here in Arlington, I was picking service berries, which grow in some public parks here. And as I was picking, this little boy wandered up to me. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm picking these berries." He started to pick one. I said, "Well, get a dark one. They're the sweetest." And he took a bite, and it was electric. He just lit up. And he went running back to his father. And his father was on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of wandering through the park very slowly. And he goes, "Dad, we got to do this every day. This is so great." And his father looks at me and looks at him and says, "What's our rule about eating things that we pick up?" You know. And he's reining in this kid. He's not only not encouraging him, he's discouraging him, which is a way of getting in touch with nature, with the natural world.
True.
And I talked to the man, I told him what I was doing, and I offered him a berry, and he ate it, and he goes, "Yeah, I guess it's not bad for a wild berry."
For a wild berry.
And I thought, you know, what a sad
yes.
commentary that is, that wild berries are sort of inferior to what we could buy in the supermarket.
Well, that's the state of our food affairs these days. And so even though you describe yourself as the suburban hunter-gatherer, in writing the book, you decided to branch out a little bit, and you did a lot of traveling, and you came down here and had what you described as an adventure among the Cajuns.
I did. I, through a series of phone calls, I found a wild craw fisherman named Mike Bienvenu. And I came down, and the first thing he did was take me to his houseboat. It's kind of a floating hunting camp that he had along the bayou. And I was just bowled over by Louisiana hospitality for about 3 days. Within 5 minutes of meeting people, I had them offering me the keys to their house if I needed a place to stay, and people were feeding me left and right. And after a few days, Mike said, "You need to go duck hunting with Jody Mesh." By that time, I had surrendered and was just went where I was told, because it was useless to protest. And Jody Mesh took me duck hunting from his hunting camp up the Whiskey River Pilot Channel. We took off one morning in the dark and went on four-wheelers and then got in a canoe and then rode until I thought he was about to crash the canoe into a huge cypress stump, when he told me to duck my head, and I did, and the canoe slid under the cypress stump, and there was a hole in the bottom of it, and we climbed up into it. We were inside the tree, and that was his duck blind.
Well, I'm a bit of an outdoors woman myself, and so I have a fair amount of swamp adventures. I've been on some alligator hunts. I've done some things like that. But I have to admit, I have never gone frogging. You had a great frogging adventure in Louisiana.
I did. I got my introduction to frogging in the drive-through line at a McDonald's. We had to feed Jody's son before we went frogging, because his mother wasn't home and we were going to be out late. So Jody was telling me, he was saying, "Now, Bill, when you get out there this evening, you're not petting that frog. You're not slapping that frog. You got to grab that frog." And his hand shoots out and just crushes the styrofoam cup that kind of explodes inside the cab. There's this loud noise. I never would have believed a styrofoam cup could be so loud. And little bits of styrofoam floating down like I'm in a snow globe.
The frogs in the Louisiana swamps are pretty wily critters in some ways, because they can fool you, right?
That is true. I grabbed one, and the thing went absolutely limp in my hand, and it was just the most unsettling feeling. And I said, "Oh, Jody, there's something wrong with this frog. It's sick." And just then, the frog jumped out of my hands and was on the floor of the boat trying to jump out, and I fell on the thing with both hands and pinned it. Jody just laughed, and he said, "Bill, that's one of Mr. Frog's best tricks. You know, he'll play dead till you loosen your grasp, and then he'll jump on you."
Oh, boy. Lots of great stories from your wild eating adventures. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us on Louisiana Eats.
Thank you.
Bill Heavey in his new book, It's Only Slow Food Until You Try to Eat It. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, author Adrian Miller joins us for a conversation about soul food.
I think of soul food as being more intense than Southern food, and a limited repertoire of Southern food. So to me, there's a stronger emphasis on variety meats, so the neck bones, the oxtails, chitlins, that kind of thing. I think there's more intense flavoring, so I think soul food tends to be spicier.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, LCI Workers Comp, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Life Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh, consulting producer Margaret House, and sound engineer Guy Mulladew. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time.
Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.